Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little boy named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Tony Reed, naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. Thanks for supporting us for the past 100 episodes. Don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support us by visiting our Patreon page, where you can find out how you can join us for our monthly patron webinar, where we do a deeper dive discussion about all things perimenopause.
The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast. This is Dr. Tony, and today I have the great pleasure of welcoming back friend and colleague, Dr. Kate Hadfield, to really discuss everything you need to know about your cervix. Because, you know, so much is unknown, I think, for most women when it comes to our cervix. When we think about supporting our health as women, I mean, we've talked with Dr. Kate about our pelvic bowl and kind of our creative center. This is something that she's really passionate about. But also really looking at, you know, beyond what we know of how to take care of our cervix. We're not really educated as women to really look at our health completely and look at all of our different body parts and how they really come together in terms of our health. Especially with something like our cervixes. I mean, most of us know, okay, pap smears are really important. But what's important beyond that when it comes to our cervix, to really not only support the health of our cervix, but prevent things like cervical cancer. And, you know, Dr. Kate Hadfield is definitely the expert around that. We talked way back in episode 36 around our pelvic health. I love that conversation that we had. So if any of you didn't hear that, or you want a refresher, go back to episode 36. We'll link to that in the show notes. And you know, the reason why I always look to you, Kate, for that information, because again, as a naturopathic doctor, your birth doula, lactation educator, you're really passionate about helping women connect to their creative center and their natural body rhythms. And you trained with physical therapist Tammy Kent in the US to be able to provide holistic pelvic care, a really gentle internal body work treatment with the mind-body approach. And that is so key to really look at, again, making those connections to our health, not just on that physical piece, but also the emotions and the energetics behind that as well. So I'm so excited to dive into all of this with you, Kate. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you again for having me. This is my favorite thing to talk about right now. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Great. I love it. And now, like I said, you know, a lot of women don't necessarily understand what's even happening with their cervix, let alone what's going on with, you know, a pap smear. Like I know, you know, growing up, I knew that, again, at a certain point, it was important to start getting a pap smear with my family doctor. And it was actually when I was in naturopathic medical school at CCNM out in Ontario that I had a pap and it came back abnormal. I was told, okay, it was abnormal pap smear. It's just an ascus, but, you know, come back in another 6 months. And that was basically it. Thankfully, while I was going through school, I was working with a naturopathic intern so that I could share that information with her because I got freaked out. Like, oh my God, an abnormal pap smear. What does this mean? But I didn't get a lot of information from my family doctor. I didn't even know what questions to ask. But I worked with my naturopathic intern to really support my health with nutrition because, you know, she let me know, yes, there are things that we can do beyond just waiting until my next pap smear. And again, that thankfully, you know, turned things around and I was fine actually until I had another abnormal pap smear. When I had a pap smear done in my first trimester, when I was pregnant with my daughter, Frankie. So I even kind of like, I felt a little strange about even getting a pap smear at that time, because it felt like it didn't necessarily feel like something that necessarily had, you know, I had to do. Couldn't I have waited a few more months until afterwards? But I didn't really question my family doctor at the time. And since then I've switched family doctors, but I didn't feel comfortable about advocating for myself at that point. I didn't necessarily feel empowered around like knowing what was the best thing for me. And I didn't want to feel like I was doing the wrong thing by not looking at that. So, you know, you have lots of conversations with your patients around not only, you know, pap smears, but also the health of the cervix to really look at, you know, switching that idea of that experience being really, you know, really freaking out at that experience and not looking forward to a pap smear and having this all of this anxiety and kind of unknown around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing you had touched on there is really key, is that this lack of empowerment around our cervical health really comes down to a real lack of education around our cervical health. So a huge portion of what I do in practice is just teaching women about this part of their body, right? So I would say we have to take it even more basic and just ask the question, like, what is a cervix? If you ask most women, they probably don't actually know what their cervix is. They know, if you say cervix, most of them will be like, well, I need to have a pap. And like, so this is kind of the main messaging, is that I have a cervix, it needs a pap. And that is the extent of my knowledge. Maybe I know it dilates during labor, but that's about it. Right. And so even just to bring it even to a more basic level and saying, like, I have little pelvic models that I show people in practice, that your cervix is actually part of your uterus, right? It's the only external portion of your uterus because it protrudes into the vagina itself. So you can see it, but it's not a separate structure. It is actually part of your uterus itself. So, I mean, that's really huge information for most women.
That could be really mind blowing for some women out there who are hearing you say that as well.
Like, what is it? Right. You know, and it basically looks like a donut. So it's a circle and it has an opening in the middle, which is the cervical os, which is leading into the uterus. And that's what would actually dilate to allow a baby to come out during vaginal birth. So just really basic things, I think, is really important just to orient women with what this area is.
Yeah, because there's this piece of a lot of women not, again, it being so much of an unknown. And even that question of what it looks like, where it is, what it's a part of. I think really those basics and that foundation is really key before looking at, okay, actually, you know, then how do we take care
of
what do you do around keeping that part of your uterus healthy? Because we don't necessarily think about those kind of, not only that, you know, piece that's more external, but even the internal pieces. How do we keep the uterus healthy would also
be a question. And understanding that you can actually have some impact over it. It isn't something you just have to sit back and hope for the best with. You have a high degree of influence over your cervical health. And that is really not well communicated. And just going back to what the visual of it is, I mean, clearly this is a difficult to access part of our body. It is not an elbow. It's not just hanging out for the world to see. So as naturopathic doctors, some of us are set up to do pap exams, and I'm one of them, and I've created what I call empowered pap, PAPs. And so one of the things that I offer during a PAP exam is, you know, do you want to see your cervix? We're there. We've got the speculum going. So, and now everyone has a phone with a camera. So it's very simple. So what I offer my patients is that, you know, do you want to see your cervix? And so if they want to, I just take their camera and we take a picture of their cervix. And then after the PAP exam is done, I basically take them on a little tour guide of the picture, just explaining what they're seeing. And women get so excited about it. We'll have so many women that after they have the PAP exam, they'll end up at reception and be like, can you see this picture of my, like, this is amazing. Because most women have never seen it. And it's a really cool looking structure.
That's amazing, because I don't think I've ever seen my cervix. So, So now with you saying that, I was like, okay, maybe my next PAP, although again, a few years from now, I'll remember to be like, okay, can I have a picture?
Or you can do it yourself, right? So you can purchase speculums online, super easy, right? And then all you need is like a decent flashlight, or like I have used an iPhone light before. They're somewhat helpful, but like a more focused light can be helpful. And, you know, take a mirror. And there you go, right? And so this is another big conversation with cervical health, is that we don't need someone else to help us access it. Right? Like we're very quick to like outsource access to our cervix and like help with our cervix and that intuition that we all innately have. And so one of the things I love doing is basically being like, no, you can do this. And so, you know, I get that not everyone's trained with the speculum, but they're really not high technology here. Like it's a pretty basic function. So anyone can figure it out. There's tons of YouTube videos. There's tons of stuff online. Another thing that I offer during my PAP exams is that like, I don't even need to touch the speculum, because I find that that's the most anxiety inducing part of the exam, because it's just like, there's discomfort. Of course there is. So if the woman wants to be in charge of insertion of the speculum, I can just help to kind of guide the angles, but that's it. Like we've got lots of time. There's no need to rush this. So if you want to be in charge of inserting a speculum, go for it. Right. And you don't only have to look at your cervix when you need a PAP. If you want to see what your cervix looks like, buy a speculum. Like that's easy. And check it out. Right.
Amazing. Okay. I might be trying this out, Kate. Really you interesting.
Now, and women also don't know that speculums come in different sizes.
That's a right? key piece, right?
Huge, huge part of the discomfort can be an incorrect speculum size, right?
Like someone using too large of a speculum.
Too large. Yeah. So we stock small, medium, and large. I have never used a large. If we're on the fence with what size we should use, I bring out both and I show the patient and I ask them, like, what are you more comfortable with? And as long as they understand that if we choose a smaller size, then we may just not have enough access to visualize the cervix. And so they just have to understand that we just may need to go up the size. But as long as that's explained to them, no one ever has an issue with that, because you're erring on the side of comfort. Right. Most people are okay with that idea. Right. So,
and just because you've had a baby doesn't automatically mean that you need a larger speculum.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. I don't think I've ever used a large. No, like the large is quite big. So yeah, it's haven't had to use it yet.
Perfect. That's amazing. Cause and again, different women will have different experiences with their family doctors and their, or gynecologists in terms of their relationship with them, how comfortable they feel, or even how rushed they feel in an appointment. Yes.
So. Yeah. Like an 8-minute appointment, you know, like my pelvic floor gets all closed up even thinking about that, right? Like I don't want a speculum exam in 8 minutes. That sounds horrible, like gross. And so I can appreciate that, you know, physicians have time constraints and all of that. So it's not a criticism of, you know, what they have to deal with in terms of practice management, but like an 8-minute appointment is not conducive to a good PAP experience, right? And that's another thing to challenge. Like we have definitely settled for these really uncomfortable invasive exams because that's all we think is available to us. And it just doesn't have to be that way. You know, like these are definitely sensitive exams, but I reject the notion that they need to be invasive. So let's honor that and have time. So, you know, like my PAP exams are between 30 to 45 minutes. And sometimes it takes us a while to find the cervix. You know, they can be tricky to find. They're not always right in the middle. You know, I've had to go in at like certain angles before to find a cervix because most people are not midline creatures. So that's fine if you have the time to do it and there's an effective communication, right? So I'm always talking with my patients. There's like never silence in the room and they're never just staring up at the tiles the whole time. Right. I always like to explain to them what's going on.
That's amazing. Now, and I'm sure everyone listening is like, okay, where is Kate? How can I get an empowered PAP with her? And for those women out there who maybe aren't in Calgary or not mm-hmm. willing to fly to for an empowered PAP with you, sure. What do you find are the key pieces that really can make that experience the most comfortable or more comfortable? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have a practitioner that you trust.
Yeah,
for sure. And like, honor yourself with that piece. I think again, as women, we're socialized to not cause problems and to not make issues out of things and to just go along with what makes everyone happy. And so be willing to be like, no, like I don't have a problem with my family doctor, but maybe I don't feel the most comfortable with this practitioner. And so for this type of exam, I'm going to seek someone out that is just more sensitive when it comes to this type of a procedure. And so I think oftentimes I've heard really good feedback for like women's clinics, like specific or even like sexual health clinics, just because they are up in that business a lot more frequently than a lot of practitioners. So, you know, that would be something to look at as well. And then know what you can advocate for. Like, again, what size speculum is your practitioner using? And if they have a problem with you asking that question, I'm like, you don't have to continue the exam, right? Like
what?
You can always stop, right? Like if you don't like how things are being approached, stop, leave. That's totally fine, right? We can't unfortunately use lubricant during a PAP exam because it can disrupt the actual PAP sample. So that's frustrating, but they should at a minimum be using water. You can always dip a speculum in water to attempt to create that type of lubrication. So that's another thing to ask, like, are they going to use that? And so it's just those types of conversations at a minimum, just to kind of know. And then another thing would be body position. You know, do you have to be lying down on your back or could you try to be sitting up, right? Because even that, like it makes it more difficult for the practitioner, for sure. Yeah. It does, but that's not the primary goal, is not our comfort. Right. And just the act of like lying down in the lithotomy position can be very triggering for a lot of people. So just knowing that, like, that's not the only position. If you, depending on where your cervix is, it might not be possible to find a cervix while you're kind of in a sitting up position. So just understand that you may have to change positions. But if most women are fine with that, you know, and it's still just coming at it from a real place of authentic patient choice.
That's amazing to really, again, this idea of we have a choice as women, as a patient with, it's not just about doing what a doctor tells you to do or what a doctor thinks is a good idea, but it really is about questioning that and really, again, connecting with that gut and that instinct of what really fits in and saying something when you are uncomfortable instead of not just wanting to you know, get it over with or not wanting to have any conflict or make waves or anything like that.
Or like bring a friend with you, have someone else in the room. Amazing. I mean, most offices are fine with like having a nurse or receptionist in there, but you probably don't know that person. So it's not really the same thing as having someone you're close with in the visit. So like, any office should be fine with that. Like if they're not, then this is not the office that you should be getting this done at, is for example. And another thing to remember too, like what we mentioned about, you know, looking at your cervix when it's not a pap situation, that situation you can use lubricant for because you are not going to disrupt any sample. And so that's actually much easier on you if you want to look at your cervix on your own time. So.
That's great. That's a good thing to know. Now, and there's also the piece, I don't know, are you also supporting your patients with doing their own pap smears as well? Or is that something that you recommend having someone else do for you?
I think it's entirely possible for women to do it on their own. I'm more than happy to walk through it with them and kind of like send them home with those items or, you know, walk out of the room. It can just be a bit tricky, right? Because like it can be hard to find a cervix. So I can share this, that I needed a pap last year and in the fall, and I actually did my own pap in office. It was hard to find. So it was challenging. But I did find it. So I was quite proud of myself. So again, like that's totally a thing that we can do. But I haven't had many women be too interested in that, because I think I'm able to develop the rapport with them that they would rather just kind of have the person who knows what a cervix is going to look like. And, you know, there's just a bit of efficiency that comes with that. But if someone was really intent on it, it's not a big deal. We can support that.
Yeah. And because like the pap smear is all about getting, you know, an accurate sample of cells. Mm-hmm. And kind of just, you know, brushing the surface to get those cells in order to have, you know, send it to the lab to look at the cells, to look at the health of the cells. So yeah, I can see how a lot of women would just say, okay, Dr. K,
you do that.
You know,
you can do that.
I trust you. You can, you got this.
Yeah. Because it's not just the surface of the cervix. So again, going back to the donut comparison, we do want to sample cells from the inside of the os, that opening. And so you do need to, like with the broom or the brush is what the collection piece is called. You do want to make sure the tip of that gets into the os, because those cells can be very important to cervical dysplasia. And if you're just swiping the face of it, then you're not really getting as accurate a picture. So that technique part is important.
Yeah. Now, and with all of this talk about pap smears, it makes me think, is this test still necessary? Is this kind of invasion of our cervix? Do we really need to be still doing this? Or, you know, should we be beyond pap smears by now?
It's such a good question. And unfortunately, the answer is that it depends on where you live. So Australia is a really good example of this right now. They are doing away with pap exams, and they are strictly relying on HPV testing. And so I guess we should back up slightly in that, what is the point of a pap exam?
Right.
So it's not just to really like check, quote unquote, the health of your cervix. It's to check for any signs of a cervical dysplasia or signs that the cells that make up the cervix are abnormal or changing in a way that could eventually lead to cancer. So that is the whole point of PAPs. It's a really good preventative measure and has dramatically decreased the rates of cervical cancer because it is most often caught before it reaches that stage. So that's kind of the point of a PAP. Now, the overwhelming research supports that the vast majority of cervical cancer cases are due to HPV infection, right? So that's the human papillomavirus, and that there are a few strains of this virus that are responsible for the vast majority of cervical cancers. And so we can also test for the presence of HPV in the cervix. And so that's why some countries like Australia, like I was saying, they're doing away with PAPs because they think that it's more valuable to strictly test for the presence of HPV. And if there's no HPV, you're probably not going to have any cervical dysplasia. And if you are testing positive for HPV, then maybe you want to look at this, the cervix itself, to see, are there any type of dysplastic changes? Because you can absolutely have an HPV infection without any changes to the cervix, right? That can also be true. A great thing about HPV testing is that it can be done at home. by yourself. You don't need a care provider to do that for you. You can take a sample. And I know that they were trialing it in some areas of Canada, like in some rural areas that just don't have access to this type of testing. And so they were looking at women doing their own HPV testing to do that. But I don't know that it's gained very much traction. In the States, you can order online at-home HPV testing kits, but Health Canada has not approved them here at this point. So going back to what I initially said, it largely depends on where you live. It has nothing to do with health.
Awesome. It's great to hear.
So great. So at this point, I think there's still a lot of purpose in doing PAPs. However, there is a bigger picture that we need to understand.
For sure. And that is around how each woman's body is responding to that HPV differently, to that virus.
The HPV infection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we basically assume that everyone is going to get HPV. Like that is a baseline assumption. And I think that's another area where there's been a lot of poor messaging because most women I speak to have a lot of shame around HPV because I think the messaging has been that it is an STI, right? Like, you know, you've caught it and you should have avoided it somehow. It's on par with, you know, like gonorrhea or something. And it's really not that, right? It's just wrong to think of it that way because it's just a pervasive virus. Like there's over 150 types of HPV.
That many?
Everywhere. Yeah. Whoa. The vast majority of them don't cause dysplasia, right? There's about 12 high-risk strains of HPV that can cause like the precancerous types of dysplasia. But yeah, but HPV itself is just everywhere. And so I remember one thing that we had learned in naturopathic med school was that, you know, what are the risks associated with having cervical dysplasia? Like, what are your risk factors, you know, increasing your likelihood of having it? And one thing we always got told was that a high number of sexual partners increases this. And I remember hearing this at a conference one time, and it occurred to me, like, the research defines everything. This is a fairly subjective standard. Like what one person considers a high number is not going to be the same as the next person. So I actually asked the presenter, I was like, what is the research defining as a high number? Because like, they're going to have to define it. And she kind of laughed and she said, okay, so right now the research defines it as anything more than 3.
Whoa.
And I thought, okay, not what I would have guessed. So, and I've seen different papers define it differently. I have never seen it above 10. So that's also really good for women to understand that, like, basically, if you're having sex, you will meet HPV. So we really shouldn't be emphasizing whether or not you've been exposed. I'm assuming you've been exposed, and it's much more about how your body can handle this infection upon exposure.
That's so key to think about. And I mean, it does, you know, make me think, okay, I mean, part of our conversation today isn't necessarily about vaccines or, you know, that is a topic that is an important conversation to have with your family doctor, with your healthcare provider, to make that choice, whether that makes sense for you or not. And regardless of someone's vaccine status for almost anything, but especially around HPV, I always think, especially individually, about what can you do to beyond that vaccine. I mean, we did have an episode with Dr. Taylor Bean, even just to for anyone who's interested in wanting to optimize how their body responds to a vaccine. You can definitely, you know, we'll link to the in the show notes to that episode, and you can kind of check that out. But going, you know, beyond or regardless of someone having a vaccine, you know, what are those pieces of how someone can really clear that infection versus have it cause dysplasia in the cervix?
And so that's the other big educational piece, is that dysplasia is caused by the persistence of HPV in the cervical tissue. So the cervical tissue itself actually has immune tissue. Like, there is immune tissue in the cervix, which is wild, right? And it makes sense, because it's like, it's part of your body that is meeting the outside world. So of course it needs to have a component of the immune system, because it's a barrier, right? Like, it's a check. It needs to make sure it can understand what is not you and what is you. So that just makes sense from a physiological perspective.
You're blowing my mind right now. Okay. Yes. I never thought about the cervix as having immune
but of course
tissue
it does,
in
right?
it, but of course it would.
Of
that's
course.
That's
of course
what,
it does. I know.
Amazing.
Right?
Amazing.
Right. So it has immune cells in there. And upon infection with HPV, like, that's where HPV is going to hang out, especially in the cells that are changing their types. So there's two different types of cells. And so there's one type that lives basically like inside the cervix as it's going up into the uterus. And then there's a different type of cell that's on the face. And so they change as they're going out onto the face. And so that's where HPV can really hang out and cause a lot of problems, is in that transformational zone, as it's called. And it can persist. Now, for most women who get infected with HPV, they will, if you did absolutely nothing, you will clear that infection within about 2 years, right? So that is the expectation. And it's really the expectation for women under 30, right? So there are some places that don't even test or even offer testing for HPV under the age of 30, because it is assumed that your body can clear it capably. And for the vast majority of people, that's totally the case, right? If you're over 30, then we start to get a little more concerned. Your immune system tends to decline in function the older you get. That's just true of everyone. But not everyone's immune system functions the same, right? So I had one patient who had a really high degree of cervical dysplasia. And when we went through her health intake, she had other types of things with her immune system in her history that were definitely red flags. You know, she was getting outbreaks of shingles in her late 20s, which is just not a thing that you should be experiencing in your late 20s. And it's like, okay, like, so from my naturopathic perspective, it's like, well, what's going on with your immune system? Because like, that should not be happening. And so we see that in conjunction with getting, you know, like, really sick every winter season, and you're not able to get rid of this HPV infection. And so the longer it hangs out in your cervix, the more problems it's going to cause. Like, these things are not disconnected, right? So even just talking about that immune system connection there, and that really we need to help support your immune system to clear the infection, and then you will not have abnormal PAPs anymore. Like, that's huge. Like, that's a huge conversation that's just not had mainstream. There's just no connection between the immune system and cervical dysplasia.
I can't think of any kind of conventional mainstream messaging out there around our cervix, around pap smears, around HPV, where it really actually talks about your immune health and how your body handles viral infections.
No, not at all. But that's what this is. It's a viral infection, right? That's it. That's what it
right.
is. Yeah. Yeah. So, wow. So as you're going back to your question, we had to do a lot of kind of like side notes to kind of give the clear picture there. But, so what can you do in terms of supporting your cervical health? Well, one of the main things is immune system support, right? So of course we would look at diet and, you know, so are there enough of these, you know, various nutrients that are in your diet? So we really love things that are high in vitamin A, right? So all of our orange and like red reds and yellow veggies out there. We love those types of things. There's good research behind vitamin E and cervical health and the immune system. That's another one. You know, what's your sugar intake like? Is that going to suppress your immune system or stress it at a minimum? So those are some main things. And then there's lots of like really good, juicy, like immune supports out there that have really good research for cervical dysplasia, like various mushroom combination products. Those are really good ones that are well supported.
That's awesome. And we're not talking about like mushrooms that have psilocybin in it.
No, but, like, I'm not talking about fun mushrooms like that.
Not the fun mushrooms, but probably, you know, mushrooms like reishi and those kind of medicinal mushrooms that are getting a lot more visibility in terms of supporting health. I it's not unusual for me to have patients who come to see me and are taking, you know, having reishi tea or shaga tea or things like that. So
yeah. And the research really does support, though, when it comes to cervical dysplasia, a combination of mushroom products. So it wouldn't just be one in isolation. It would be those high dose combo products.
Cool. That's really good to know. And then I would now, do you know, is there any research around cervical health and vitamin D? Because when I think about immune system health, I definitely think about vitamin D. I mean, we did a whole episode on vitamin D a few months back.
Exactly. So it's the same thing, right? Like there's so many things. And so we always have to balance, like, you know, I don't ever want to have the intention of giving someone 15 different supplements just because there's research behind each of these. We have to see the forest for the trees, right? And so it's like, well, what are these things a marker for? So ideally we really, you know, make sure we're buttoned up on the diet and include all of these things in a dietary way. But if someone is experiencing dysplasia, then we will need to supplement some of these things in addition. So, you know, vitamin A, C, E, I don't know, zinc, D, those types of things, those are really important. And I always love testing for vitamin D because some people have that SNP variation where even we could be like mega dosing them with, you know, like 8,000 IUs, but if their genetics are a particular way, they're just not going to benefit from it. And so then, you know, those are really good candidates for, you know, vitamin D injection therapy too. Absolutely. So it's worthwhile testing.
Oh, and that's such a good point to make as well about, again, that genetic in variety and each individual has kind of their own different ideal dose of to get a really an optimal level of vitamin D in the body too. So that's key.
Yeah.
Now, does that also, does it make a difference in terms of what their grading or scale of dysplasia is like? Can you talk really maybe briefly or
like about like kind of explaining the scale or So one of the most challenging things I find with women who are going through like colposcopy clinics is trying to understand the lingo because it is really challenging and it's not intuitive. And it's not well explained, unfortunately. So, you know, what typically happens, and of course there's differences, but typically you go for a pap, it comes back as abnormal. If it comes back as like a high degree of abnormal, they'll most likely give you a referral for a colposcopy clinic immediately. If it's a lower grade concern, they'll likely say, just come back in 6 months and we'll do another pap. And then most of the time it's not an issue, right? So therefore you've cleared the HPV infection. It's not in your system anymore. If you're going to a colposcopy clinic, they're going to explore the types of lesions in a little more of a deliberate manner. So we kind of understand it in two big ways. So there's LSIL, L-S-I-L, and then HSIL, H-S-I-L. So this is basically low-grade lesions and then high-grade lesions. Under those categories, you have, you know, something like ascus, which is like, there's changes, but we don't really know what they are, but they're there. And those are the low grade ones. And then you'll hear things like CIN 1, 2, and 3, and that's CIN, CIN 1, 2, 3. So CIN1 is low grade, CIN2 and 3, those tend to be more high grade. Sometimes 2 is classified along in there with 3, so it can get a little complicated. And then after that, you get AIS, which is adenocarcinoma in situ, which is basically cervical cancer that just hasn't spread to other tissues at that point. And then after AIS, you have cervical cancer, which means that the cancer cells have invaded local tissues there. So that's the overall grading system. And so you'll see both the diagnosis of like LSIL or HSIL, and then the CIN 1, 2, 3 or higher in addition to those. Those are all on a colposcopy report. So it can be very confusing. Understandably, it's really confusing.
So. I have to say, you know, for the majority of the patients who come into my office who have or had cervical dysplasia, they typically don't know what level it was, what grade or what it was, you know, it was just
They don't know. It's not well explained to them. No. I have yet to have a patient come in who said, like, they sat down with me and explained my diagnoses. Most of them are like, well, I never heard from them, so it was probably fine. And so before we do any type of cervical treatment, I always requisition the reports from the colposcopy clinic, and I'll even write out a timeline for my patients if they've had like multiple procedures and stuff, because it just helps them understand what's going on with their body. But even that's not enough. Sometimes I've had some patients who've been given a diagnosis of AIS, which is basically cervical cancer that just hasn't spread into those tissues yet, and they don't know. And I've had to be the one to deliver that information to them in the visit because it hasn't been explained to them. And that's really unacceptable. But it happens quite frequently.
Oh, that's shocking and incredibly disheartening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible.
So now we've kind of talked about nutrients. When is, and I'm sure, you know, women will ask, okay, you know, especially depending on what grade they're experiencing, okay, what can they do about their dysplasia? Again, looking at diet, looking at nutrients, but is mm-hmm. there anything that can be done locally in terms of yes. supporting the cells?
Right. So typically from a mainstream perspective, what they will get offered, and this does vary based off of where you live too. Mm-hmm. So speaking from where we are in Canada, the most common procedure that gets recommended is a LEAP procedure, right? And so a LEAP procedure is where part of the cervical tissue is cut away. And it's a significant portion of the cervix, and it is, it cuts away the unhealthy cells and the healthy tissue at the same time. And so they're basically taking like an electrified loop, a metal loop that shaves off a portion of the cervix. Of course, it does grow back. It's not like it's permanent that way, but that's generally the approach. And so that's a LEAP procedure. Some areas will offer a conization, which takes like a cone-shaped sample out of the cervix because that can get much deeper than a LEAP can. And then some LEAPs are also followed up by laser ablation, where they're lasering part of the cervical face to try to get rid of those cells. And so that's typically what is offered from a mainstream perspective, with varying degrees of success, I would say. So that's what you get offered from the typical colposcopy clinic. What I've started offering is called escharotic treatments. And so these are topical treatments that we do to the cervix that theoretically identify the unhealthy cells and target those while sparing the healthy cells.
So a really, I don't know, would you say a more gentle approach or just a really almost more accurate approach where it really is more targeted for the cells that really need it?
Yeah. So the theory behind escharotics is that the types of solutions that we are using, which is a combination of zinc and a few different herbs, target the cells that have an abnormal cellular membrane transport system, which is really commonly seen with any type of dysplasia. And it's well documented. So it's well researched that these cells have different membrane transport systems. Mm-hmm. And so this combination of zinc and sanguinaria is the main herb that targets this. And I also use curcumin, they highlight these lesions and you can see it. So when we put the solution directly onto the cervix, it lights up the lesions. So sometimes you can see them like just with your eye when you're visually like looking at the cervix. Sometimes like the lesions are large enough that you can see it. But once you bathe it with these solutions, it lights it up. And a colposcopy clinic actually does something similar, right? So before they do a colposcopy, which is different from a LEAP. So a colpo is basically like a big magnifying glass where they can zoom in and see what's going on. And so there's not necessarily a procedure associated with that. It's just a diagnostic tool. But before they do that, they also apply different types of solutions to light up the lesions, and so they can better identify them. So that's like common practice. But what we're doing is taking it another step further to then target those particular cells and activate the immune system to help fight off the infection at the same time.
That's fantastic. And then do you literally see that change in this in the cells of the cervix as you continue with treatments?
You can. Yeah. So I have definitely seen lesions shrink visually. I feel the most confident once they have a follow-up colposcopy. That's what I trust the most. Yeah. Because sometimes you'll see some shrinkage, but you'll still see lesions remain, but then they go have a colposcopy and it's clear. So I would never go just upon visual inspection alone. I would always follow it up with a colposcopy just to see what's going on. That's valuable information that people should have access to. But yeah, like after, you know, we tend to recommend between 8 to 12 of those treatments, ideally, depending on the degree of the lesion. But yeah, usually after about the fifth one or so, you can see those areas shrink, which is incredible. That's incredible amazing. To see it.
That's fantastic. And I love that you're really, again, providing something that is something other than just, you know, wait, you know, watch and wait. And for, you know, women to actually know that, you know, they can impact the health of the cells on the cervix, that it's not all just about putting it in other people's hands, but, you know, you can really make a difference with your health. And I think the information and the support that you're giving women is just fantastic when we're talking about really looking at this area that most of us don't know a lot about. And even I learned something new from you today, Dr. Kate. So
well, as escharotics are so fascinating because, like, even we didn't really learn about them in school. There's a high degree of misinformation out there about it. So if you Google escharotics, you're going to find some pretty scary information that comes up because there's an assumption that escharotics are the same as what's known as black salve treatment. So salve being S-A-L-V-E. And that's because of the herb that we use. So the main herb that we use is called sanguinaria or bloodroot. If you use that herb in a paste and put it on your skin, you will burn away your tissue. Like, that's true. Like, and that used to be something that people attempted for various types of like skin cancers and things like that. And that is categorically not what we're talking about. But there has been a lot of people out there saying that these two things are the same. And so to be explicitly clear, we are not putting a paste of sanguinaria on any cervixes whatsoever. We're using a zinc extract that's been compounded from a pharmacy with two types of tinctures. So an alcohol-based extraction. I think I use maybe a teaspoon in total of all of those things. We're flushing the cervix with it, and then we are washing it off. So this is a very key thing because there is so much misinformation out there about what an escharotic treatment actually involves.
I appreciate that clarification. That is so important to know. And now, especially since there is so much misinformation out there, how can people connect with you, Kate? How can people, see what you're up to and really, again, be able to find that information that you're providing out there, regardless of where they live?
Sure. So my website is yourpelvicnd.com. And I'm on Instagram at yourpelvicnd. And so those are the two main places that I hang out these days. And so I update there quite frequently.
Perfect. So we'll definitely link to your website and your Instagram handle in the show notes for people to be able to connect with you, Kate. So now, are you ready to kind of switch gears around talking about cervixes to talking about our super mom moments?
Absolutely. I could talk about cervixes for like 5 more hours. So we should probably switch at some point. So
I don't know if anyone out there would be interested in hearing more about talking about cervixes for 5
There's
hours.
So I mean, much more.
I mean, I'd love to. And okay, maybe another time. Now, is there a super mom moment that you can think of where you just rocked it lately. I know you're a mom of two. So
I am. Yeah. So I know last time I was on here, my mom mess up moment involved my eldest throwing up. And so now my super mom moment that I'll share still involves my eldest throwing up. So we'd picked him up at school and he was complaining of feeling overheated because he was wearing like his full snow gear. And he was like somewhat feeling okay after lunch, but we had to drive to go get haircuts. And so we went in the car nonetheless. And like, just as we get onto the highway, he is like, I am not doing well back here. Like you could see like, oh man, I was like, are you gonna be able to make it to this turnoff? And he was like, no, like you have to stop. And so I managed to just like pull over right away. Thankfully there was a shoulder. And, you know, he like was popping himself out as I was braking and we managed to like get him out of the van and he got sick all over the side of the highway, like twice, but then he was done. And like, so this is where like the super mom moment comes in. Like he didn't hit his clothes. He didn't hit my shoes. He didn't hit the van. And like, as soon as he was done, he just like wanted some water and perked up. And off we went to the hairdresser. It was like the most epic throw up moment ever. So it was like, perfect. It didn't interrupt anything. It was so tidy. So.
Amazing response from Supermom to just like get it done and then
get her done.
Back on your way.
It was incredible. Amazing. So, amazing. I bought myself some Starbucks afterwards just to reward myself.
So. You deserve that. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, this weekend I had a super mom moment that then kind of quickly even turned into a bit of a mama mess up, because I feel like previous super mom moments have been around mitts, especially in the spring when it's so wet out. Whenever I go, take Frankie out to a park or what have you, I'm usually a really great and I'm like super mom moment, remembering to take another pair or two of mitts, especially if she's not wearing like waterproof mitts, then I know that those mitts are going to get soaked and her hands are going to get cold and wet and she's going to be miserable. So that was our first outing this weekend where I was like, yeah, pull out the mitts. My mother-in-law was there. So she was like, wow. And I was like, yes, I'm amazing. And then the next day we went out again, met up with some friends at a park. And as soon as we got to the park and I saw all of the puddles all around, I thought, oops, I think I messed up. I didn't bring another, pair of mitts. And then not only did her hands get soaked and cold, her feet got soaked and it was just, okay. Even before an hour, we hit the hour mark, we had to get out of there because it was like, it was done and it was, warm, but cold enough that it just wouldn't have turned out well. So I felt like that was a little bit of a mama mess up and I mean, not the worst. So, but still a learning lesson, like every time got to at least take two pairs of mitts. Now you're an amazing mom, Kate. And can you think of a mama mess up lately?
Of course. But so this one is more so about like just not listening to my gut about things. So we recently withdrew my eldest from an extracurricular class that he was in. Mostly like he was enjoying it fine, but it really wasn't aligning with what my values are as a mother. And so there was an expectation of homework that I don't think was age appropriate for him. So there was that expectation. There was a lot of kind of demand outside of lesson time. I found the provider to be fairly difficult to manage. And so it had just reached a point where I was like, you know what? I'm buffering him quite well from this stress, but I'm certainly taking a lot of it myself. And I just don't think that we're gaining a lot of benefit from this and it's not necessary. And so I feel like for me, a lot of this year comes down to embracing what's aligning and it just wasn't aligning anymore. So we decided to just step away from that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, good for you. And that really does sound like not only kind of like a learning opportunity, but you really like, again, stepping into, you know, being what, you know, a mom is about in terms of being able to say no and not just kind of carrying on. So it almost kind of sounds like a little bit of a turn into a supermom moment, Kate. So good for you.
Oh, I think so. I mean, and I think we should see a lot of our, you know, mess up moments, if you want to call them that way, is just as learning opportunities. Totally. And so, yeah, it's just about like tuning in what makes sense and embracing that opportunity and moving forward with it.
Yeah. Awesome. Good for you. Thanks. Now, mama must have time. And here's even a little bit of an update, because my mama must have this week is my Aura ring, and I had lost it. It was gone for a week. And so I wasn't going to take credit with a super mom moment about finding it. It was actually Frankie who found it under the coffee table. So I'm just going to, just go with it. Fantastic. And I love my Aura ring. I really do think everyone should have it. I mean, not everyone can afford it. And if you can, it's amazing. I love it in terms of tracking my sleep, my stress, looking at my heart rate variability and kind of overall health. It has a new program about tracking temperature. So I'm curious if that really turns out to be accurate or not in terms of tracking cycles and that kind of thing. Anyway, I love my Aura ring. So that'll be my mama must have for this week. How about you, Kate?
So I'm 3, I guess almost 4 months into going to Pilates consistently. And so like reformer Pilates, not mat Pilates. And I am absolute fanatic about it now. So it has built such a great baseline of strength for me. And just strength building is so important for women's health in general, from like any way you look at it. But the thought of going to the gym and lifting dumbbells is just death. Like I have no desire to do that. It is boring. It is bulky. Like the best thing about that for me is I get to listen to music. So like, there's no way I will continue to do that. Whereas if I go to my reformer class, it's the closest I will ever get to feeling like a dancer, because I'm so not a dancer. And I'm also very tall. So I feel like it's really well suited for tall women. It focuses on building core strength, pelvic floor strength. I feel elegant. It's just fantastic. So I am a huge fan of my reformer Pilates now. So.
I love that. I used to do reformer Pilates before COVID. And I missed it. So
yeah,
I love that. Thanks.
I love it. No more masks at it now either. So yay.
That almost makes me think, oh, maybe I should get back into that. Thanks.
You should.
Kate.
It's so nice. I love it.
Oh, awesome. So Kate, thank you for joining us today. Thank all of you out there for joining us today. Again, you can find our show notes at perimenopausalmamas.com. You can email us and connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We would love for you to subscribe, especially if you enjoyed this awesome episode all about cervical health today. Leave us a review and a 5-star rating, and you can also support us by visiting our Patreon page. So stay safe and healthy, everyone.